Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out, procrastination, putting it off, kicking the can down the road. In, plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out, carpet in the bathroom. Like, why? In, knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
97.1 FM Talk.
On-demand audio.
I kind of like that little Sue, History in the Lewis Sue promo there.
How about it?
We call that inventory.
Yeah,
right? Inventory,
yes.
Commercial and promo. You got some inventory on the show. I'm very proud of you, Sue. That's
Thank
great.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We have an audio cut of the day coming up here before the end of the hour, but I'm so excited. I told Fred this morning, I really want to talk about this Karen Reed thing because I got so into the documentary on Max, and I said, Fred, you got to find out if Paul Morrow's on top of this. And he is, of course, Fox News contributor, retired NYPD inspector, attorney, and a founder of the opsdesk.org, which is a great site. How are you, Paul, this afternoon?
Doing good, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. Here's my quick take on Karen Reed. I think she did it. I think there's a lot of reasonable doubt. I think the prosecution was a mess, and it was a good TV show. Outside of that, I don't know much more.
Yeah, you know what? That's as fair a summary as any. In the prosecution's defense, they were a little overmatched. My understanding is that they were a little under-resourced, and they came up against a really first-rate defense attorney, somebody who's used to the camera, who knew how to work the room, Alan Jackson. He's going to be there the second time around as well. But this time, it's going to be quite different because Jackson is facing a much more experienced prosecutor who's had time to get his legs under him. And my understanding is that the atmosphere up there in the courtroom these days is quite different than the first time around. Jackson's been losing motions left and right. Brennan, that's the new prosecutor, has been quite aggressive at holding the line. The judge seems to tilt to the prosecution now because there seems to have been some indicia of irregularities, let's call them, on the defense side. And so Jackson seems a little rattled, so this is really going to be fascinating.
So let's back up a little bit and give the details of what happened here. This goes back to, I think, 2022. It was a snowy night in January. Everyone was out at a bar. He's a Boston police officer. They're hanging out with other cops. It's a bunch of people that get together and are friends on a regular basis. Then they decide to go to another friend's house who's a police officer, and that's where kind of things change dramatically, right?
Yeah, so they're out drinking, and she's got, that is, Karen Reed is with her close boyfriend, who's also a police officer. His name is O'Keefe, and they go. He's relatively new to the area. He's taking care of the children of his deceased sister, so he stepped up to do that, and he's relatively new to the area. They don't know him that well, but they like what they see, and they invite him back to this home. The problem is Karen Reed doesn't know any of these people. And so apparently she did not want to go. That's not in dispute. And in fact, he has to get directions. It's not like he knows them so well. He has to get directions to go there, to the house, because he doesn't know the area and he doesn't know the people. So they get to the house, and that's where the stories diverge. Her story is that he got out of the car, went to the front steps, was going to give her a high sign as to whether or not it was, quote unquote, okay to go in. And she has said this in the interviews that she's giving. I wasn't sure we'd be welcome and all sort of stuff. And so I was waiting for him to kind of give me the thumbs up. He goes in the house and he doesn't reemerge. I don't know what to make of it. I have to go to the bathroom. I'd had 9 drinks.
Yeah.
She weighs like 100 pounds, this woman. She's had 9 drinks with reportedly a New England thing called a sidecar, which is essentially a shot on the side with some of these 9 drinks. So she's pretty banged up. But anyway, her story is that he doesn't reemerge, and so she has to go to the bathroom, and so she drives herself to his house and goes to sleep on his couch, and she wakes up to the fact that he hasn't come home.
But she also calls his cell phone, I think they indicated, 53 times
what?
That morning, saying, cussing him out, John, where are you? John, this. Now, I don't know if the theory is that she did that to create cover for, you know, for doing this. I legit, Paul, think that she might not even realize that she ran him over because she was so intoxicated. So then that leads me to, you know, why did they charge second-degree murder? Because this seems to be, no matter what you think about Karen Reed and whether she did it, second-degree murder seems to be overcharging here to me.
So that's a very salient point. And I got to tell you, that's kind of where I was for a long time here. I couldn't figure out why they went with murder two. And a lot of very experienced assessors here, people who work in criminal justice, have said, well, one of the reasons that the first jury hung is that they overcharged. Here's the nuance.
Okay.
And I agree with your assessment, by the way, because when you hear those messages that she leaves him, that she's not acting. She thinks he's alive. She's furious at him. She's cursing him out. And she gets kind of particular. It's like at one point she's calling him a pervert.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know if something went on in a car with them or what, but like she's really pretty mad at him and she thinks he's potentially getting these messages. I don't think she's actor enough to have faked that. No, she's alive. She thinks he's alive. Here's the thing. She intended to hit him, you would need to get the murder charge. You would need an intentional murder. Murder two mm-hmm. is what the charge is up there. She intended, however, in my estimation, and I think in the prosecution's estimation, to hit him with the car. Now, if you intend to commit a felony and then somebody dies in the commission of that felony, you have felony murder. Now, generally, felony murder off of an assault, if off an intended assault, just gets marbled into manslaughter. And that's it. Apparently not the case in Massachusetts.
Okay.
This is what I am being told. Because I cannot come up, and I have to buy it, because I can't really come up with another theory as to why you would be so dogged in charging the murder, too. You could say it was the fact that she didn't render aid, or something like that. You could come up with some novel theory. The fact that she knew he didn't come home, knew that she hit him with the car, didn't go to check on him. You could try to come up with some theory like that. But the best answer I've gotten from somebody who does, you know, should know, is that under the felony murder charge, that is, you intended to commit another felony, which in this case would be assault with a weapon, the weapon being the car, and then he dies, you have the felony murder charge. The classic example you always hear is, okay, you go in to rob a bank.
Yeah, right, right.
And as you're fleeing, you shoot because somebody steps in front of you, or you shot up in the air to try to scare somebody, to bullet somebody.
Still
murder. And now you got felony murder.
Yep, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, well, so, like, even if Sue and I go and rob a bank, and I shoot someone and I kill someone, Sue can still be charged with felony murder because she was taking part in the bank robbery. And Sue's a big bank robber, too, so that wouldn't be that would not be too much of a stretch. You know, one of the things, Paul, I've said in this circumstance is because I'm very familiar with the situation with the Stephen Avery case from Wisconsin and Making a Murder. And there's not a guy on the planet that's more guilty than Stephen Avery. But that show made it seem like he wasn't guilty. So there's a big difference in what a TV series does and a documentary
Absolutely.
Than what's reality. So I know I didn't sit in that courtroom every day. I do see reasonable doubt. I see some weird things, too. Like, you know, the people that were inside the house, Sue, including an ATF agent and other cops, there were phone calls that they tracked from there that were claiming to be butt dials. So the calls were made back and forth. It was an abnormal, like an unbelievable amount, like 9 butt dials, which
no one would
believe. So there's weird stuff like that, Paul, that also happens that really does lend to the reasonable doubt. But again, unless you're in that courtroom for the whole trial, you wouldn't really know all that.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover, all for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code MAN at checkout. That's harrys.com, code MAN. Enjoy.
I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new Unrivaled League, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I think that you're right. There are some aspects of it. To me, you know, the phone calls can be teased out. There might have been something else they were discussing. For whatever reason, they're not coming out. Who knows? I mean, the cops, maybe they were trying to order up some weed or something. And, you know, I really don't know what it is that would be would explain the fact that there were butt dials that nobody wants to sort of or there are phone calls that nobody wants to really explain beyond saying, hey, butt dial.
It is weird.
It is weird, but to me, the dispositive piece in her favor that I understand why the jury had some real trouble convicting here is the Google search.
Yes.
That, to me, is the real, because it's digital, and apparently the data can be interpreted a different way, but just to tease it out real quick, there is on one of the witnesses, one of the fellow attendees at the party, there is a Google search that occurs at around the 2:30 hour, saying how long to die in the snow, essentially.
Oof. Well, and they even misspelled. It says HOS, so they because people do that, right? It says HOS.
Yeah, right. She misspelled how long.
Right.
So, but you know, it's pretty clear she meant how long. So, you know, the interpretation that came out at trial that I think really swayed the jury, and my understanding is that in some interviews, et cetera, after the case, some of the witnesses have alluded to the fact that that really swung them. And, you know, the idea was that at 2:30, this person who was at the party, this woman who has absolutely nothing against O'Keefe, none of the people at the party seemed to, she was Googling how long to die in the snow well before it had come to light that he was, in fact, dead in a snowbank. And so she must have known that he was out there and dying, and they were waiting for that to happen. But apparently, the company they use to dump the phone is a company called Celebrate. It's their software. I'm very familiar with them. And that data has some leeway in how it's interpreted. And in fact, that leeway came to light to such an extent during the trial that Celebrate went in and changed their software. Because in their estimation, and in the estimation of a lot of other experts, what happened was that the phone had remained open. It had never closed. That this woman, Jennifer McCabe, that's her name, that was at the party, went home herself at about 2:30, went to bed. The phone didn't lock for some reason, or Google stayed open.
Safari, I think Safari, yeah, Safari stayed open. Sue, the case that they made
is... Yeah, Safari, the browser stayed open, right.
The case that they make does sound somewhat feasible, but I checked on this. So what they're saying is, because then you get to the point where there's a bunch of Google searches, but they're at 6:30 in the morning. The prosecution has experts that claim, well, look, she had Safari open, so at 6:30, because it was open from 2 a.m., that's when the search is indicated. But I checked with George Rosenthal, one of our IT experts here with ThrottleNet, and he says this: the ethical hacker that he asked the question of said all those searches would show up in history, assuming history wasn't cleared, additional steps taken to cover tracks, etc. It organizes by date and in order, but if you don't see a timestamp exactly on the regular view, forensics could find the exact time of each search and how they're spelled. My question was, did we just miss that because the documentary doesn't show everything that happened in the trial? I'm guessing that's going to be further clarified in this trial, and you're going to get some more answers, because I can understand how the jury would be confused by that, Paul.
Exactly. And there's two metrics that you could use there, because first of all, you could go to the company that owns Safari. In this case, it's going to be Apple, and you're going to get their logs and say, okay, dump the log. And this happens in cases all the time. They got Brian Koberg's Google searches. They got the Google searches from Rex Heuermann out here on Long Island, in New York over here, who killed, allegedly, a bunch of prostitutes. So, you know, you could get that, or you could get the metrics from the phone itself. That is, you dump the phone and you get essentially like a keystroke, for lack of a better term. And you can see what was punched into the phone at what time. And from my understanding, what I've seen, and again, I wasn't in that courtroom, but I'm pretty familiar with it. My understanding is that what they went with was, again, the Cellebrite dump of the actual activity on the phone, and that's where the wiggle room seems to come in. And the phone, if in fact was active, that Safari remained open, then the prosecution's contention is that, like you said, in the 6 o'clock hour after the body was found, and that's Jen McCabe's testimony, by the way, that at that point Karen Reed said to her, check how long it takes to die in the snow. Google that. That she, in fact, did it at Karen Reed's instruction.
Which makes sense,
though. That would be a whole different... Okay.
It is, but it does make sense. But I can also see how it, you know, plants reasonable doubt. Look, the whole whole case, Paul, is... Did you watch the documentary or not? Did you watch the series?
Actually, I participated in a documentary on Fox Nation that covered the case. So I'm aware there's another one out there. I don't know what
Yeah, that's the one on Max that's drawn a lot of people. Look, they timed it out, so it's right before this trial. It's a really, really well-done series. But again, that doesn't mean that it reflects the truth of what happened. But one thing I was going to tell you is the one thing that there's a lot of things, Paul, that jump out at certain people, and for you in particular, as someone who's been in law enforcement as an attorney, the prosecutor in this case that they first assigned, I've been in courtrooms, Paul. I've seen prosecution. He might have been the worst prosecutor I've ever seen in my entire life. He was so bad. He had no personality. He was fumbling over himself. It was really, really bad. Now, again, selective, you know, cuts because I'm seeing it in a documentary, but they moved on from that dude. They got a new guy in here, and I think he's got to do better because there's no one that could possibly do worse than the other guy. That's what I'd say.
This guy, Brennan, is apparently sharp as a tack, very, very experienced, former prosecutor and a former defense attorney. So he knows both sides of the aisle here. And my understanding is, as I said, they've really, look, they don't want to lose this.
It would be devastating.
Because, you know,
yeah, but see, the thing that makes this unique is, and this is why it's a little, you know, sleazy as well, is as soon as she's, you know, prosecuted for this, they bring in the Netflix cameras, the documentary team. So this documentary is with her every day of the trial. You have all these people, we haven't even addressed this, all these fans of hers that will probably be there tomorrow cheering her on. They're wearing pink. She's become this cult, you know, this pop culture hero because a lot of people think that it's malfeasance on the part of the Boston Police Department. It's an inside job and all this stuff. So the case is fascinating. I get why people are, you know, interested in it, but wow, it's a mess. That's for sure, too.
It is. And, you know, look, at the end of the day, for this to have been the conspiracy that Jackson, the defense attorney, conjured, that he got the jury to buy into, you would have to have five different agencies and about 25 people, none of whom we can demonstrate all definitely know each other. In fact, highly likely they don't. You got the medical examiner's office, you got the fire department, you got Boston PD, you got all these other people that show up. They all would have had to have a reason to, and then the time to sit down, work out this elaborate plan for some reason, all of these people being career law enforcement, let's get this guy back for no motive that's clear to any of us.
That's the
get
problem.
Him in the basement.
Yeah, there's no motive.
Beat him to death and stick the dog on him and then leave him in the snow in front of our house, by the way. And then when they do the investigation from the federal side to see, remember, and this goes to the butt dialing you were talking about earlier, remember, the feds came in and looked at this case for police misconduct. That's how far Jackson pushed this.
Yeah.
He had this theory so complete that the feds came in and did an assessment to see, do we have a police misconduct case here? And not, and that hung over the first trial. Well, not only was there no indictments on the federal side, but in fact, the federal case was closed with no indictments, which is essentially an endorsement of the fact that there was no collusion, no conspiracy on the police side. Expect that to come in this time as well.
We have made this, and they've done this because they made a movie. We made it so complicated. I swear, Paul, I think it's pretty simple. I think that there is a lot of alcohol going on with all these people, and we all know people that are in these cliques. I can name a few here in certain parts of St. Louis. I think they were out. They got way liquored up. She got pissed because she's crazy. I think John O'Keefe was a little crazy himself, and she ran him over. And she might not even remember it because she was so wasted. But we're going to see what's going to happen in this second trial, Paul Morrow. We're going to have you be our correspondent. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
You got it,
buddy. All right, take care. Audio cut of the day is coming up.
Get more at 971talk.com.